From the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm Stephen Cuevas, sitting in for John Horn. On today's show, Amazon is transforming the way we buy everything from books to groceries. Now, it's hoping to do the same at the movies. And then, it's time to...
Pick up the dance, mother...
Wayne Kramer, founding member of the legendary Detroit band the MC5, talks about his new memoir that chronicles half a century of rock and roll and rock and roll excess.
The establishment is critical of us. The music industry is critical of us. And I discovered the wonderful pain-killing properties of Jack Daniels and heroin.
All that coming up on The Frame.
KPCC podcast supported by National Geographic's Genius Picasso, starring Antonio Banderas in the Emmy-nominated role as the 20th century's most influential painter. Nominated for 7 Emmys, including Outstanding Limited Series. natgeotv.com/FYC. And the HBO series Barry. NPR claims it's the best new comedy on television. For your Emmy consideration. Nominated for 13 Emmys, including Outstanding Comedy Series.
Welcome to The Frame. I'm Stephen Cuevas, sitting in today for John Horn. Thanks for joining us. Amazon has long been a marketplace upsetter, shaking up the way we buy books, groceries, and just about everything short of real estate and life insurance. Customers experienced a bit of anxiety a couple years ago when Amazon's acquisition of Whole Foods was announced, as spoofed on the Jimmy Kimmel Show a couple years ago.
Welcome to Amazon Whole Foods. Would you like to try our pita chips and hummus?
Oh, yes, sure, I would. Thank you very much.
Did you like that just the one time, or would you like to have it every other month?
The one time. Good.
You know, people who bought that hummus also enjoyed our tzatziki dip and our AAA batteries. Would you like to add those to your cart?
Now Amazon is reportedly in talks to buy the Landmark Theater chain, which operates about 250 movie screens across the U.S. But Amazon, through its subsidiary Amazon Studios, is also, of course, already in the movie making and distribution business. So to find out how such a deal may shake up the movie theater biz, we called Bloomberg tech reporter Spencer Soper. He says it may hinge on scrapping a decades-long law known as the Paramount Decree, a rule that prohibits studios from owning movie houses.
There was concern that movie production studios had too much control over what people saw, which movies appeared in theaters. Some of it was also geographical, that there was too much concentration of ownership in particular markets. And so these rules were put in place to help the market be more competitive and reduce the amount of control that movie production studios had over the movies people saw and the prices people paid to see them. So those rules go back 70 years. They are getting a fresh review now. So the rules could be done away with or modified.
What were some of the other factors that led to a review of this Paramount Decree?
It's part of a sweeping review of antitrust decisions going back decades. The factors are just that they're so old that they're now getting a fresh look. Simply the age of these agreements and also just market changes over the past 70 years. It's tough to say that people lack choice in what they want to watch right now.
Well, Landmark typically showcases smaller foreign and indie films that might otherwise be pretty hard to find. If a big content creator like Amazon wants to break into the brick-and-mortar theater business, why start with a chain like Landmark?
Well, there's overlap in that philosophy. So if you think about Amazon's origins as an online bookseller, and then its foray into electronic book market, and its dust-ups with publishers, a big thing that Amazon did in the book industry was take on traditional gatekeepers. So like Landmark giving a venue for indie films, Amazon has been a place for independent authors to get exposure, to reach big audiences without having to go through the traditional book publishers. So there's some overlap between Landmark wanting to expose the smaller, lower budget films and Amazon's approach on books.
But Amazon presumably would want this deal to happen so it could showcase its own content, correct?
That would be a part of it, but I don't think that it would be an exclusive thing. Amazon generally wants to give customers choice. That would certainly be a big piece of this. Amazon spends billions of dollars a year creating content. It's trying to find a better footing and get more traction, you know, get more people engaged with its video content. It's still kind of a distant second to Netflix in terms of streaming. It's won some critical acclaim, but it hasn't had any big blockbuster hits. But the bottom line is, if Amazon's opening theaters, it's not going to just cram its own content down its customers' throats. It's going to be mindful of what its customers want to see.
What's the reaction been, if any, from the National Association of Theater Owners, which represents some 33,000 movie screens across the U.S.? What's their reaction been to a possible deal like this?
I haven't seen much reaction in that regard. Sometimes there can be, when Amazon announces any kind of foray into a new business, there can be an outsized reaction. You know, like when they announced their purchase of Whole Foods, a lot of supermarket stocks went down, that sort of thing. But this has been a little more muted. It's 50 theaters, you know, so it's a fairly small market. And then it could actually be a good thing to have Amazon encouraging people to go to theaters, because it's just been a difficult business with so many people getting big screens in their homes and streaming content on demand that, you know, movie theaters are still just struggling to fill the seats.
Well, if Amazon is successful in purchasing the Landmark chain, could such a deal open the door for established legacy studios like Paramount to also get back into the movie theater owning business?
Potentially. And like we said, a lot of the rules that would have prevented them previously are getting a fresh review. So I think that the outcome of those Justice Department's decisions around those decade-old consent decrees would probably weigh in more than anything Amazon is doing.
And if such a deal went through, how to prevent what originally led to the Paramount decree in the first place, meaning, you know, the monopolization of the movie theater business?
A lot of times these antitrust rulings, in particular with physical locations, it won't even be like a sweeping ban, like for antitrust regulators to say, like, no, this deal can't go through. They would just set caveats on it. So if one store chain is buying another store chain, or one movie theater chain is buying another movie theater chain, and they're worried about concentration, it'll usually be market by market, and then they can still get the deal through by divesting themselves. And then there has been a lot of chatter around antitrust with Amazon just in general. But by and large, with the exception of books, they really don't have market concentration in any one category. And it's hard to say that anything you buy on Amazon, that you can't buy it anywhere else. Generally, everything that's available on Amazon, you could find a place nearby or another place online to buy the same exact thing. So the antitrust argument, the way it stands now, it's a difficult argument to make about Amazon.
Spencer Soper is tech reporter for Bloomberg. Spencer, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Hey, so the Emmy Awards are exactly 1 month away on September 17th. We here at The Frame got a head start by putting together a preview show that features some of the nominees, including Carrie Brownstein, Sarah Silverman, Bill Hader, Brian Tyree Henry, and many others. The Frame's Emmy preview debuts this Sunday, August 19th at 8 p.m. here on 89.3 KPCC. Stay tuned for more of The Frame, including a chat with Wayne Kramer of the influential band MC5. He's written a memoir detailing the high times and hard time of his 50-year career. Few bands burned as ferociously as Detroit's MC5. The band's driving sound and restless experimentation became the building blocks of punk and metal. Its 1969 debut album, Kick Out the Jams, is now considered a classic, landing the number 8 spot on Rolling Stone magazine's list of the 50 best live albums of all time. The MC5's founding guitarist, Wayne Kramer, is celebrating the 50th anniversary of Kick Out the Jams with a massive U.S. tour featuring members of the bands Soundgarden and Fugazi. It coincides with the release of Kramer's memoir called The Hard Stuff. The book chronicles his stint in federal prison and a rocky return to music, sobriety, and advocacy for prison rehabilitation. The book starts with the brief but explosive history of the MC5. Kramer says the band was driven by the rough-edged R&B and rock and roll booming out of the Motor City in the mid-1960s.
I was most attracted to music that had drive, that had a pounding rhythmic bass to it.
That was common with Detroit bands at the time, quite unlike what we were hearing, say, on the West Coast,
right,
London, and
right,
so on. It wasn't right about flowers in your hair and love beads, right?
No, it was about that rhythm driving the music forward all the time.
Are you ready to testify? Are you ready? I give you a testimonial, the MC5!
It seemed that all the artists that I loved the most worked at a high energy level. Their emotional content was at a high pitch, you know. And when you worked that hard on stage playing, people responded more.
How did they respond?
They respond with a spontaneous exuberance that you can find in no other human activity. There was a connection between the MC5 and its audience that set us apart from our contemporaries, the other bands of the 60s and early 70s.
I wanted to ask about John Sinclair. At the time, he had become your manager, and he was a poet, a political provocateur.
Mm-hmm.
He ends up managing the band and becomes also kind of like a creative kindred spirit, I guess.
Absolutely, yep.
What was his influence exactly on the band at that time?
He introduced us to the free jazz movement.
Artists like
John Coltrane and Albert Eiler and Cecil Taylor and Pharoah Sanders and Archie Shepp and Sun Ra.
So help me understand how free jazz kind of informed what you and the band were doing.
Well, what I learned from the free jazz guys was that you could actually leave the Western concepts of key and tonality behind, along with Western ideas of counting time. Hmm. Pretty soon you're going from da 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 da. And the time is still there, but you're not playing it anymore. You have to still be conscious of where time is, but you're letting the adherence to those musical rules go.
Did things ever just come apart on stage?
Of course. It happened all the time.
Most of the band's songs were not overtly political, but was playing as loud and as fiercely as you did in itself kind of a political statement for you?
Yeah, well, rock and roll, you know, is inherently rebellious and political. So, you know, I mean, and then, you know, there's times when the songs are overtly political. I mean, a song like The Human Being Lawnmower, which was just a brilliant composition of Rob Tyner's, and the lyric was incredibly powerful, poetic, metaphorical allegory for the draft being a lawnmower that eats human beings.
They're trying to force you to help them. Do what they do. So they're hunting around you, chasing from around you till you're standing before the human being lawnmower.
Chop, 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 chop,
chop, chop, chop, chop. Yeah. Speaking of all the political activity and such, that kind of contributes to your band's, to the band's manager being arrested and being sentenced to a 10-year prison sentence on what ostensibly was a drug charge,
two joints.
He'd go free in 1971, though, but what impact did the arrest and the trial and his imprisonment have on the band?
It was devastating. John was our interlocutor with the outside world. We were crazy. We were nuts. I mean, we were 17, 18, 19-year-old teenage boys. That, you know, things became untenable for the MC5, you know. I mean, almost all bands break up, but you have to remember the MC5 never pulled the golden horseshoe out of our ass. You know, we never had a hit record, you know, and not being able to make any money being in the MC5 was another huge contributing factor to the band's inability to maintain and survive.
Well, you also write very openly in your book, The Hard Stuff, about your own drug use, your own drug dependence. You and bassist Michael Davis start dabbling in heroin, eventually become quite addicted. Was that a contributing factor to the end of the band, or was it a way to kind of shield yourself from all the other hassles and headaches that were coming down on the band at that time?
Well, it works out both.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
You know, because I built the MC5 on sheer willpower and youthful enthusiasm. You know, I wanted to do this. And then I reached a point where, I have limited power. I can't control people, places, and things. And it became painful, you know, to constantly be faced with failure on, you know, on every level. You know, our own allies in the revolution are critical of us. The establishment is critical of us. The music industry is critical of us. I discovered the wonderful pain-killing properties of Jack Daniels and heroin.
And that eventually comes to take over your life. You continue to play music in one form or another right after the band's breakup, but drugs really take over. You become a full-fledged addict and a thief. You write about some hairy moments where you could have lost your life or killed someone yourself. Eventually, you do get busted by federal drug agents with a hefty amount of cocaine. Were you, in a sense, relieved because you wouldn't be exposed to that world on the outside? You'd be exposed to other things on the inside, but at least you didn't have access to drugs.
Not true. There's plenty of drugs in prison. Yeah, I kind of had this idea that I was going off on this monastic sabbatical and I was going to meditate and I was going to study music and I was going to try to improve myself. And when I arrive in the federal penitentiary at Lexington, I realize I'm in a small town of all hustlers and scamsters and crooks and liars and thieves. And there is no monastic side to this. This is insanity.
Well, when you got out, you slowly rebuilt your music career. But the drugs, you kind of slid back into your addiction.
Addiction is a very complex, chronic mental disorder. And until the addict is ready to change, nothing is going to change them. And in the end, I couldn't even get myself sober. I needed help. I couldn't stop on my own. But I'd moved here to Los Angeles, and I was 50 years old. I wasn't using street heroin anymore. I wasn't shooting up. Now I had prescription medicine from doctors. And I could drink every day. But as time went on, I started to meet more and more people who didn't get high every day. I thought, that looks pretty good. How do I do that? Show me how to do that. And when I started to ask people to help me, they helped me.
You would actually return to prison, but in a much different capacity, as co-founder of an arts rehabilitation program with the British singer-songwriter Billy Bragg. Jail Guitar Doors USA. For those who don't know, tell us what the aim is of the program exactly.
Sure. We teach reentry skills and problem-solving skills for people serving time in America's jails and prisons. We do it through music, and we task the men and women with writing songs that address how do I take responsibility for my actions. How do I make amends? Is it even possible to make an amends? How do I avoid falling into the same mental framework that got me here in the first place?
Well, the program Jail Guitar Doors is, of course, named after an old Clash song from 1979, a song that name checks you. And now it's a song that you've since performed yourself. And it just so happens, Wayne, that there's an acoustic guitar in the studio. And I'm wondering if maybe you'd like to play the song. Shall we?
Shall we? All right. So let me tell you about Wayne, his deals of cocaine, a little more every day.
That's Wayne Kramer, guitarist and founding member of the MC5. His new memoir is called The Hard Stuff. Up next on The Frame, the young members of the L.A. band Interwave have a sound that's straight out of South L.A.
Bang, go the jail guitar doors. Bang, bang, go the boots on the floor. Cry, cry for his mother's only son. Clang, clang, go the jail guitar doors. Bang, bang, go the jail guitar doors. Doors. Bang, bang, go the jail guitar doors. Bang, bang.
KPCC podcasts are supported by National Geographic's Jane, a film by Brett Morgan and the most Emmy-nominated documentary of the year, called one of the best documentaries of all time by Vogue. The film profiles legendary conservationist Jane Goodall and was created from over 100 hours of never-before-seen silent archival footage. Nominated for 7 Emmys, including Exceptional Merit in Documentary Filmmaking. Visit natgotv.com/FYC for more information. And the HBO drama Game of Thrones. Time calls it the biggest and most popular show in the world. In the epic season 7 of this colossal hit, the people of Westeros fight for their seat on the Iron Throne. Winter is here, and beyond the Great Wall that protects them, a forgotten evil has returned. The most Emmy-nominated program this year is nominated for 22 Emmys, including Outstanding Drama Series.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm Stephen Cuevas, sitting in for John Horn. And now, members of the Inglewood psych rock band Innerwave have been jamming together since they were middle schoolers. Over the past 11 years, they've gone from playing local church gigs to underground venues to sold-out shows. Just recently, they were able to quit their day jobs and hit the road on their first North American tour. The band recorded a couple of new singles this summer following their ambitious 2017 release, Underwater Pipe Dreams. Two of the group's members stopped by our studios to speak with Frame producer Jonathan Shiflett. They began by talking about their first days playing music together.
I remember saying that I kind of didn't want to start a band until I was older, like 18 for some reason. And then the next day they're like, dude, we're starting a band. You play guitar, Eli plays guitar, Gene's going to learn how to play bass. And we kind of just practiced every day. And we didn't even have our first show until like eighth grade.
Was that when you guys started that Christian rock band?
Nah.
Before I joined the band, and when they were in middle school, they had like a little Christian rock band going on.
Well, you gotta add little in front of it, bro. Yeah.
Because y'all were
little.
They
got a little.
Y'all were tiny. That. It was a tiny band. What's up? This is Chris Runners. I play keys.
My name is Pablo. I play guitar and I sing. Gene and Eli and Portillo aren't here right now. Yeah, we've been playing for 11 years together. I started playing music in church. I grew up in like a Christian evangelical church. It was all in Spanish. So the kind of music there was, it would start with like more like worship contemporary stuff. And then at some point it would just switch into like polka music almost. It's like, mm-da, 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 mm-da. But yeah, it was fun. I feel like it developed my ear. But I think the name Innerwave kind of just came about because I had a whole like list of like 200 band names on my phone.
Any bad ones you remember? Like really bad ones?
I think one of the names was Battery Baths. And that was actually the second best one. So
really?
If like a few more people would have chose that one.
Been Battery Baths?
Yeah, you'd be interviewing Battery Baths right now. The genre? Mm. Damn, I don't know. Clowncore.
Clowncore, yeah.
I've always had a hard time describing. To me, it falls under the umbrella of like alternative indie, but that's such
so broad.
Not because it's so crazy.
We're different.
Different,
yo. We're
it's
so
just
different.
Like you can't even put that into words, you know. At least for me, when I was younger, I remember being in middle school and thinking like, I'm never gonna make it. Because the only people that make music like this that make it are like white. Like yeah. People are just gonna be
especially
like, why
aren't
you singing in Spanish?
Yeah.
No, because I remember even going to shows when we were younger and like playing these shows and sometimes people would be like, oh, where are you guys from? And I'd be like, Inglewood. And they're like, really? Oh, I thought you guys were like a Boyle Heights band. It's like, oh, that's a little
kind of messed up.
Racist. I'm kidding. We really try to make a point to like write as much of the stuff together as we could.
Just because everyone in the band has so many different influences and I feel like it comes out in all the different songs. I think sometimes we'll just start jamming and then someone will be like, yo, this kind of sounds good. Let me get the voice memo on my phone and like throw it in the middle of the room real quick. And then they hop on and then we'll just like go from there.
This is Buffalo version 14. It's mm-hmm. another song from the album. I don't know if I should.
We'll jam for 15 minutes and there's like a 1 minute part that we're like, yo, we got to work on that and make that into a whole song. Pablo is definitely like the main producer filter for the whole band.
Why mix the stuff and record it? So, and then I end up kind of just playing it for the guys, just sort of teaching each part like one by one.
I really think the LA scene is picking up right now. I think it's mostly because a lot of bands are really trying to help each other and like push each other's music, and I feel like there's genuine friendships between a lot of musicians, and like they just like each other's music and we all want to see each other succeed.
It's a lot of DIY spots. I think for us that was a big thing. We started playing in like warehouses in Gardena, this place called The Colony. Shout out to The Colony. So that kind of thing is a big help. And sometimes going to venues when you're not a bigger act can be a real pain, because it's like, yeah, dude, you want to play? Yeah, like,
come bring
pay
everything. Yeah, exactly.
It's not healthy for like cultivating art.
We've been like completely independent for a long time. Like, I think until maybe February this year, we didn't have like a manager or any like PR people or none of that. It was just like us doing everything. And it was just recently where I quit my day job. This tour is really special because it's been like an extended field trip. It's like you hop on the bus. It was fun, like right before we left for tour, we're all at Pablo's house and we're like sitting cross-legged on the floor and our managers are up there like telling us like, hey guys, so just make sure to be safe. And it's like, I'm at a camp right now. Like we all have our bags packed and stuff and we're like loading in and like saying bye. And like Pablo's dad was outside waving goodbye as the van was pulling away. Just like, wow.
And one more thing before we go. When you work on a daily radio magazine like this one, you wrap up an episode and quickly move on to the next day's show. But when someone like Aretha Franklin passes away, it doesn't seem right to simply move on. And so we'll end this week with one more tribute. Aretha, Sing One For Me, is a song written and originally recorded in 1972 by George Jackson. You're hearing the version by Chan Marshall, otherwise known as Cat Power. Hey, Aretha, sing one for me. I don't know, my life's in misery. We sing a song that will touch his heart and make us sorry that we are apart. And that's our show for this week. The Frame is produced by Oscar Garza, Darby Maloney, Monica Bushman, and Jonathan Shiflett, with help this week from Julia Paskin. Our intern is Maria Alexa Cavanaugh, and our engineer is Valentino Rivera. I'm Stephen Cuevas. John Horn is back on Monday. Until then, have a great weekend. Many romances have been saved by your sound. You've touched so many lovers so many times.